You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law.
See terms and conditions. 18 plus. This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Was Peter Frampton singing Baby I Love Your Way from his album Frampton Comes Alive. Frampton Comes Alive was the best-selling album of all time when it came out in 1976, certifying platinum 8 times over, and to this day it remains one of the top-selling live recordings. It also marked a turning point in the career of Peter Frampton, launching him into a world of fame and pressure that he was completely unprepared for, and presenting the difficult dilemma of how to follow up the best-selling album of all time. His story is one of remarkable success, setbacks, comebacks, creative genius, and collaboration with many of the greatest musicians of all time, from Jerry Lee Lewis to B.B. King to George Harrison and many more. And now he writes about it all in his new book, Do You Feel Like I Do? A Memoir. Today he joins me on the show to talk about the making of that seminal rock album, Frampton Comes Alive. He recalls his early years learning to play the guitar by ear, growing up with another future rock star, David Bowie, and how he balanced or really didn't balance going to high school and being in a rock band. He tells the wild story of the time he barely escaped Noriega's Panama with his life, how he took the news of his former bandmate Steve Marriott's death in a tragic fire just as the two were planning a reunion tour, and how his recent diagnosis with a debilitating muscle disease has put an end to his days on tour, but it hasn't stopped him from recording and even producing a new documentary. Plus memories of working with the Beatles, Phil Spector, and many others, coming up with Peter Frampton in just a moment. Peter Frampton is among the most celebrated guitarists in rock history. His 1976 album, Frampton Comes Alive, remains one of the top-selling live records of all time. He co-founded one of the first supergroups, the seminal rock act Humble Pie, and he's collaborated with such legends as George Harrison, David Bowie, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bill Wyman, and Ringo Starr, among many others. In 2007, he won the Grammy Award for Best Pop Instrumental Album for Fingerprints, and in 2014, he was inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame. Frampton has toured with the likes of Stevie Nicks, Greg Allman, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Cheap Trick, Steve Miller Band, and many others. Frampton's latest release, All Blues, was number one for 15 weeks on Billboard's Blues Album chart. He has voiced himself on The Simpsons and Family Guy, and he's appeared on The Colbert Report, Madam Secretary, and Cameron Crowe's film Almost Famous, for which he also served as an advisor and wrote songs. Now he's written about all of this in his new book, Do You Feel Like I Do? A Memoir. Peter Frampton, welcome.
Thanks so much.
Well, Peter, I enjoyed the book, and you have led quite a life. In this book, you actually tell the story of your favorite guitar as something of a metaphor for your ups and downs over the years. Tell us a little bit about this black Gibson Les Paul that you nicknamed Phoenix, how it made its way back into your hands, and how it sort of mirrors your own life journey.
Well, this is it's one of those very strange stories. Strange or unbelievable, whatever you want to call it, because I was actually given this guitar, this Les Paul, black Les Paul with three humbucking pickups. I now call it the Phoenix because it came back from the ashes. But basically, I got given it by a dear friend in 1970, and I used it for 10 years on all of Humble Pie's stuff, and from that point on, anyway. All my solo stuff and every session I played on during those 10 years. And then in 1980, we had a plane crash with all our equipment on in South America, and we thought all was lost. Unfortunately, I was just told that there was nothing left from the plane crash, so all our equipment was gone. But to fast forward, 30 years later, I got an email to my info@frampton.com, which I read them. Info. There were like a dozen photos of my guitar now, and or at that point, which was a few years ago now, 2010, I think. And I screamed and said, "That's mine, and it's alive. It's alive." And so it took another couple of years to actually get the people that had got the guitar to want to sell it. And finally, it took two more years after I first saw that it was alive. And a little bit of a gray area there, but basically it was on the island of Curaçao, just off the coast of Venezuela, Caracas, which is where the plane crash was. So, and then 32 years after I lost it, it came back and they brought it to me from Curaçao, and we filmed the whole little thing. It's on YouTube, actually. Because I wanted to have it on record of it coming back into my hands. And it was, it's a nice little piece. You should watch it. It's, from that day on, I renamed it the Phoenix. And if you wrote that story and gave it to a film company, they'd say, "Yeah, that could never happen." Well, it did, you know?
So for years, this guitar was just sitting in some guy's hand on Curaçao, and he just had no idea what he had, huh?
I think that's debatable. That he didn't know what he had.
Right.
I think that the father had bought the guitar from somebody in Caracas, moved to Curaçao. And then stuck it in the closet. And then when a new generation, his son, comes along and gets to guitar playing age, he asks his dad, "You know, that old beat up guitar in the closet, can I take it somewhere to get it fixed? Because it won't play." And so he said, "Yeah, sure." And that was his big mistake, really, because he took it. In the end, it wasn't a mistake because the kid got a new guitar or enough money to buy a new guitar, which was great. That was my reward to him. I didn't know the. I still don't know if that guitar could speak. You know, it's like the red violin. You
right.
know?
Yeah. And, exactly.
The son went to a luthier in Curaçao. And who happened to be an immigration officer for his second job at the airport. So it's all a little gray there. And finally, the kid came back to him after he was told, "You know what you have here," and he ran away. So 2 years later, he came back and said, look, how much will you, I want to sell it. I want this amount for it. And so that's when we started working on getting it back, and it came back to to Nashville.
And related to that, you actually opened the book with this wild tale of you and your bandmates booking a gig in Panama and then barely escaping that country with your lives in, I think, 1980. And this is back in Manuel Noriega's day. That's straight out of a movie, man. I have to ask you to tell that story.
Yeah, well, that was all because of the plane crash. So right. We were in Caracas. We had a day off. We went to Panama for our day off, and we were going to play the big football stadium there the following day. And of course, I was at lunch in the restaurant, and my road manager came to me and told me of the crash. And so I said, okay, we need to go to every music shop in Panama and see if we can get, we had nothing. We had no PA, no drums, no guitars, no amps, no nothing. It was all gone. And so about 4:30 in the afternoon, when you're supposed to have a sound check, all the crew knocked on my door, came in, and the only thing that they had that I thought was could have been workable was for the talk box, they'd gone to a plumbing supply and got one of those black tubes that comes out of the back of the washing machine. And it wouldn't work. That wasn't going to work. And they said, this is all we got. And a bunch of guitar cables. That was it. No guitars, nothing. So basically, our road manager, Rodney Eckerman at the time, had to tell the promoter we couldn't play the show. There was no equipment, and there wasn't any equipment in Panama to be able to fill a stadium with a PA system or anything like that. So that's when the book opens, and this promoter, who is probably the brother of Noriega, who knows? But basically, right. our promoter was Noriega. This was just his right-hand man. And he goes in, and he says, Rodney, his name is. He's sitting out by the pool, and we're looking out the window, listening to what they're saying from one of the little hotel rooms, and we're watching them sit by the pool. And this promoter says to Rodney, "Rodney, let me tell you this: if Peter Frampton does not play the gig, first I will kill you, and then I will kill Peter Frampton." So that's how the book starts.
Wow. So how the hell did you get out of there with your life?
You got to read the book for the rest of it, basically. But we escaped we have to thank the non-existent Pan Am Airlines. They were incredible. Not even the American consulate in Panama was any help. They kind of said, you're on your own. But when we got back, the end of the story is the funniest part for me is, I guess about 3 weeks after, I was in New York with my wife at the time, Barbara, and we woke up, and it was a Monday morning in Manhattan. We'd been in the city for the weekend, and it was Good Morning America, and Robin Leach comes on, The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and I just heard my name, and I woke up. And he says, well, now the true story can be told. I have it on good authority from the government that Peter Frampton, when the air crash happened and Noriega's people wouldn't let Frampton and his band and crew leave, a well-placed call was put into the White House. Yeah, right, because I'm friends with them, right? I've been there once. The CIA were told to go down there and get us, I don't know, SEAL Team wow. 6, maybe. I don't know who it was supposed to be.
Unbelievable.
But they came down and rescued us and took us back to Andrews Air Force Base. And it was all bullshit, you know. So it's like I was laughing so hard. You know, we had to escape the country ourselves, and Pan Am had immigrations on the way out, stamp our boarding pass because we had no passports because Noriega had those.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, only Robin Leach could come up with a crazier fictional version of what really happened, because what really happened is beyond belief.
No, there is one other person I do know that can make something even worse.
Who's that? Okay. I think you know. We watched the debate the other night.
Exactly.
I want to ask you about your early years and how you first got interested in music. I was amused to read that your first instrument wasn't a guitar, but rather this anachronistic instrument called a banjolele. What is a banjolele?
A banjolele is a banjo-shaped ukulele. So it's a small, very, very much smaller banjo. And my grandmother had that in the had lent that or given it to my dad just in case one day I wanted to play it. Peter might want to play this. So I'm up in the attic one summer getting our suitcases down with my dad, and I noticed this little case and realized that it was it looked like an instrument. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, that's grandma gave us that just in case one day you wanted to learn to play it." So I said, "Well, do you play it, Dad?" He said, "Yeah, I could play a few tunes on it." So I said, "Well, let's get it down." So we did. And I was about seven then. And I very quickly learned quite a few songs on these four gut strings. And by the time I was eight, or that year of me being eight, I asked at Christmas if Father Christmas could bring me a guitar. I needed the extra two strings. I couldn't quite do all the rock and roll stuff I wanted to do by the age of eight at that point. So, but
and you learned guitar by ear, right?
Yes, it's very painful to play the guitar by ear. But I learned it. Yes, yeah, no, I use a pick to play it. But I did. Pretty much learned to play from the off by ear, just watching what my dad was playing for these three or four songs he taught me, like Tom Dooley and "She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain When She Comes," that kind of freight train, going so fast, those sort of things, you know, things with two chords. And after I got to the point where I was really annoying my parents with my playing 24/7, they said, "Well, if this is as serious as it looks, you're going to be trained by a guitar teacher." And I said, "Oh, no." But I went, and it was classical guitar. So I learned a lot of theory and combined the two, learned what's on the page written with the guitar neck, basically. And that taught me a lot. I didn't like going, but I realize now that it was very valuable for me to just give me the rudiments of the guitar. I didn't know anything about the guitar.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. I think that you joined the Preachers when you were still more or less a kid. How did you manage school and being in a band?
Being in a band and being at school is not easy. first of all, I had to tell them that, you know, I could only play Friday and Saturday nights because it was a semi-pro band, but it was made up of guys from some of the top bands, South London bands. So it was a phenomenal band. And I was the youngest, obviously, at 14 when I joined. And it was, put it this way, my math teacher knew when I'd been, he could tell when I walked in the room if I'd done a Sunday night show somewhere. And he would then, and only then, give us a mental math test straight away. So, and he would look straight at me with a kind of sort of smile, you know. And of course, I failed math.
but yeah, but it paid off. You know, then you joined the herd. You got to compose some songs that became hits in the UK, and you're even named the face of 1968 by this teen magazine Rave. And of course, later on, there was this famous shirtless Rolling Stone cover after Frampton Comes Alive that I think you say kind of made you cringe. Have you always been uncomfortable with the media's desire to turn you into some kind of teen idol or sex symbol?
Yes, but I let it happen. You know, I could have said no to all these things. And I'm a people-pleasing guy, you know, and without the experience of realizing no one had the experience that I had and when Frampton Comes Alive came out, because it was it was unique in its success. So therefore, really, only I knew. I thought that it would be best to all these managers and agents and record companies and everything. They've had success before me, so they know much more about this than I do. Whereas this was something out of the norm. And I should have been the one to dictate what I did at that point. But I thought, well, they know better because they've been through this before. But none of these people had handled anything quite this big before. So the only person that knew what to do was me. But I let it happen. So I take full responsibility. A lot of people took advantage of me financially and publicity-wise. But being in my mid-20s, you know, I unfortunately went along with things that I would never do now.
You wouldn't do a shirtless cover of Rolling Stone now?
They wouldn't want one. Oh, they wouldn't want one of me now.
Well, yeah, since you brought it up, let's talk about Frampton Comes Alive. Prior to that, you had had some modest success with your studio albums once you went solo. And then Frampton Comes Alive just sets the world on fire. Certified platinum 8 times over, becomes the biggest selling live album of all time up to then. I think it's still at like number 3 or something. When you embarked on that project, did you have any sense that this album was going to be a game changer for you?
No, in a word, no. Yeah. We followed the template, as I say in the book, of Humble Pie, really, because Humble Pie had, I was with them for 4 studio albums, and then the 5th one was Rockin' the Fillmore, which was our breakthrough album, and that's when I left, before that came out. But that was Humble Pie's first gold album, you know. So... and the reason for us doing a live album is the same reason I did a live album, was that we had built such a following as Humble Pie, supporting every big act known to man over and over and over again. We'd built this huge following, and now it was our record sales weren't doing as well as our live fans. So obviously we needed to give them something they wanted. And we just thought that let's do the live album. And so when it came, it's a complete copy. It's like, as Yogi Berra says, it was deja vu all over again. When I had stayed with, obviously, A&M Records and management had... stayed with me after I left Humble Pie, and we'd done 4 studio albums, and we all looked at each other. We were at the same pitch, audience-wise, as Humble Pie was. And I just, you know, we all looked at each other. I don't think anybody said anything. We just went, uh-huh, it's time. So that's when we released the live album.
Yeah. And what about when you were performing those concerts that made up Frampton Comes Alive? Did you feel in the moment like something big was happening, or did you have to go right back after the concert and listen to the tracks to hear what you really had?
When we came off stage that night, which was our first night as a headliner in San Francisco. We were playing at Winterland, the Winterland Ballroom then. Mm-hmm. And it's about 5,000 to 7,000 people. Wasn't even an arena size, but pretty big. We all knew that we had done an excellent show. There's those nights, special nights, where everyone in the band comes off. Usually they come off and say, one person will say, oh gosh, I wish I could have played that. But this after this show at Winterland, we all came off beaming and saying, did you feel like I, you know, do you feel like I do? to quote myself. And we all did. Yeah. We all felt that was like the best show of the tour so far, mm-hmm. you know. So we knew that when we went to Wally Hyder's truck after the show, we listened to a couple of minutes of something and went, oh, wow, this is something special. And then we went down a week later. We were playing the Forum. I think we were opening for special guest with Rod Stewart at the Forum, and this mm-hmm. would have been summer of 1975. And while we were there, we went over to Wally Hyder's studio and listened to, you know, parts of all different numbers, not mixed, just all faders up, you know, zero. It knocked us back. It didn't matter how loud it was coming out of the speakers. The power of the band sound and the audience sound was so huge that it just gave you chills, yeah. you know, and yeah. we just knew we had something very special. You know what I thought? I thought, wow, I think this might be a gold record.
not certified platinum 8 times over, huh?
No.
It's interesting to me that there's no original music on that album. You're basically playing the same songs from your previous albums, and yet when I listen to a song like Lines on My Face from Frampton's Camel versus Lines on My Face on Frampton Comes Alive, it's like I'm listening to two totally different songs. How did those songs evolve between those initial recordings to what we hear on Frampton Comes Alive?
I've always been... Things always develop with me. Mm-hmm. When I write a song and record it, I'm always very, well, by the time I finish, I'm happy with it and I'm doing the best I can with it. But there's a different vibe when you walk on a stage that you have to leave any advice by anybody off the stage. No one's mm. with you. It's just you and the band. And there's something that happens for me, the live performer in me, just I become totally uninhibited and another character comes out and I become the other guy. And there's an intensity to the way I perform, I guess, that is... outshines the studio recordings, even though I love the studio recordings. Don't get me wrong. I'm very proud of those ones. But there's something about when I play live in front of an audience, when it all comes together for me. And I've never played the same solo twice. I try never to sing it exactly the same every night, whatever song it is. It's always in a constant state of change. People will recognize it, but within the song, it's definitely growing every night.
And in your book, you describe the success of that album as something of a blessing and a curse. And I remember Cameron Crowe once said of your career after Frampton Comes Alive, quote, "What happened to Peter Frampton? He got strapped to the nose cone of a rocket and shot to the moon. And when he got there, he found that there was nobody else there." That's kind of true, because when you have the best-selling live album of all time, there's no one left in your orbit. Where do you go from there? You're essentially competing with yourself, right?
Yeah. Well, at the time, it wasn't just the biggest live-selling album. It was the biggest album in the world.
Oh, right, yeah.
Biggest seller, because we had... there's two phone calls I got from D. Anthony, my manager. One was when... it went to number one, the album went to number one. and I was just over the moon. And then I don't know how much longer it was, a few weeks, maybe a month or two. I got another call from him, and he said, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "Again?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you've now outsold Carole King's Tapestry. You're now the biggest selling record of all time." So that's wow. when I got very scared, because now it's something that I've got to compete with. And I knew I had lost before I started, because this album had 6 years. You mentioned that these are not brand new songs that I've written. These are songs that I've written over the last 6 years, one from Humble Pie, a cover from the Rolling Stones, and then all the others were the pick of the litter from all my previous solo records. So it took 6 years to write that material, and I knew that they were going to ask me to put out a new record sooner than I would want to. So it was a very, very scary period for me, and the I'm In You album should not have been made when it was so close to still this behemoth. Frampton Comes Alive is still in the top 10 at this point, you know. And there was no reason to release anything for a couple of years, you know. And if you think about the Eagles, I always quote the Eagles, because you think they've had 30 studio albums. I think it's 7, and the rest are live or best ofs. And
really?
You don't want to go near the studio until you have incredible material. But in the 70s, there was a time period there where everyone was writing in the studio and taking too long, and there was all sorts of stimulants being used and alcohol, and it was a very strange time for me.
But still, and, I Mean You ended up being your highest charting single, and I want to ask about the year 1978, because that's when you're involved in this near-fatal car accident in the Bahamas, suffered broken bones, a concussion, muscle damage. How big a setback was that for you, both career-wise and just psychologically?
Yeah, you know what? It took a lot of emotion and digging deep to talk about that in the book. I think we'll leave that for people to read about, don't you?
Well, then let's fast forward to, I guess it was, 91 or so. You talk about reteaming with Steve Marriott and going on tour. Then he abruptly leaves for England from L.A. and dies 24 hours after he lands in this tragic house fire. Where were you when you learned when he died in that fire, and how did you process that news?
I was on the phone with my brother from England at the time. I was in Hollywood, California, and we were just talking, and then with call waiting, it beeped in, and I said, "Well, Clive, let me just see who this is, get rid of them." And so I clicked it, and it was another English voice from one of the tabloids in England, and this gentleman just said, "Is this Peter Frampton?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, how he got my number, I don't know, but those Brits. I'm British, that's right." And he said, "Have you heard the news?" I said, "What?" He said, "About Steve Marriott." I said, "No, what?" He said, "He was killed in a fire last night in his house." And he said, do you have a comment? I said, "No, I don't right now." And I got rid of him and clicked back to my brother, told him, and said, "I got to make some phone calls, Clive, so find out what's going on." But that was devastating, obviously, because I really did believe that we would have got back together again. We were like brothers, the Mick and Keith syndrome. And I do believe that we would have got back together, and we would have done more music together. So it was a very sad time for me.
Since then, you've continued to collaborate with so many great musicians, from B.B. King to Pearl Jam, going all the way back to your early work with George and Ringo, Jerry Lee Lewis. Has there been one particular musician who felt like a huge deal to you, where maybe even you felt a little bit starstruck to be playing with them?
I never really felt starstruck with Dave. David Bowie, because mm-hmm. I've known him all my life. Right. We were just, it's funny how you first meet is how you still maintain, you know, mm-hmm. The way you are with each other. And, yeah. but I think meeting a Beatle is for me, we grew up on, I was 12 when the Beatles came out. So this was an incredible change for the world, starting with England, obviously. They took over the airwaves and had this unique songwriting that was different, recording that sounded different. Everything was different. And it mm-hmm. was a kick up the ass for every musician, obviously, at that time. So to be asked to play with George on All Things Must Pass was incredible. And then the most phenomenal thing was after I'd done about a week of maybe 4 or 5 days of tracks with everybody else, so the whole band. And then a couple of weeks later, George called back and asked me if I would, he said Phil Spector wanted to have more acoustics. I said, really? He said, yeah. There were enough acoustics on there to sink a battleship, you know, already. But Phil Spector is the wall of sound, so he wanted a wall of acoustics. So anyway, I go back to Abbey Road, and it's just George and myself this time in that huge studio, looking through the glass at this killer producer, Phil, and Phil Spector, and we're just overdubbing on all the tracks I played on. And then George said, well, we need more acoustics. Or Phil said, we need more acoustics on this one. Oh, I said, I didn't play on that one. And George just quickly showed me the chords. So I can't remember how many I played on, but it's at least six tracks on the album.
You were recently diagnosed with a muscle disease called inclusion body myositis, or IBM. Mm-hmm. And since then, you've retired from the road. I think you were scheduled to play your final five concerts in the UK this past May, but they got canceled due to the pandemic. Do you miss the road?
Oh, I'll always miss the road. I believe it's what I was put on the earth to do, is to travel and play. I'm one of those. Mm-hmm. So, yes, of course, but I have now started a film company with my dear friend Rob Arthur, and so we're doing our own documentary. We started filming on the finale tour, and obviously all because of IBM is slowing me down, and mm-hmm. so that's why we had to have the finale tour. But we're sort of at the moment on hiatus because I don't want to have Zoom interviews in my documentary. I don't. I mean, if this continues for much longer, I'll have to. But I do want to wait until we can have a camera in front of a good camera instead of an Apple camera.
Right. I'm getting pretty tired of seeing the inside of everybody's living room in grainy videos. So that'll be something to look forward to. And in the meantime, the book is called Do You Feel Like I Do? A Memoir. Peter Frampton, it's been great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Peter Frampton for coming on the show. Order his new book, Do You Feel Like I Do? A Memoir, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.